This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawira Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann and I'm joined from Whakatane by Mawira Karatai. Kia ora, Mawira.
Good, Sam. How's it going?
It's going very well indeed. How is your week going so far?
Busy, busy, busy.
Well, that doesn't make any difference.
I mean, it's three busy today.
Today we're doing something special again. We have another in our series coming up for air.
Yes, and I'm really just loving these podcasts. I mean, it was amazing getting to spend the time with the students, but to hear these podcasts just blows me away. It's my great pleasure to introduce one of the kindest, most wonderfully affirming people I've ever known in my life, actually, Nicola Wilson. Welcome, Nicola. Lovely to have you in the class.
Kia ora, Marua. Samuel, nice to be here today. And thank you for that very positive introduction, Mawira. I just like to talk too much in class sometimes, fill up some spaces.
Welcome, Nicola. Where are you, Nicola?
I'm coming to you from Auckland today. Auckland, north born and bred, actually, but to Auckland for the last 20 years.
Yeah, we'll let you away with it today. So what do you grow up in Auckland?
I grew up in Whangarei, university in the Waikato, and basically after a stint overseas, I've been stuck in Auckland for the last 20 years. I'm raising my family here and working here. I consider myself from the north, and I can't wait to get back there. But at the moment, I'm in Auckland for the foreseeable.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
A gymnastics coach. It didn't work out, but it doesn't really pay the bills. It's a strictly a volunteer occupation for me. For many years it was. Not my own son wasn't involved in gymnastics at all, so I sort of transferred over to water polo to support him.
So what did you do instead of gymnastics coaching?
My undergrad was in a business degree in the Waikato, and then I've been basically in business roles for the last 20 years, mostly in buying. So I've got quite a lot of buying experience working for big retailers like the likes of The Warehouse, for example. They were a fantastic employer, actually. I spent many trips overseas in research or buying roles, so I've seen a bit of the world through my work, which has been wonderful.
So if the problem that we face as a world is that we're buying too much stuff, it's your fault. I'll just put that out there.
Actually, that's been a dawning realization over time. Yes, absolutely. Because, there was a time in my life where I was trying to buy more and sell more and push more. And then actually in the last few years of my life, it's like, oh, hang on, what were we doing? And we're trying to step it back from there.
So is that the work you're doing now?
Yes, I'm in a different company, but yes, similar. I've transitioned into more of a sustainability field. I'm a sustainability manager. A lot of that has been built on the back of, I did a lot of work with manufacturing and product development and site visits and knowing how things are put together. And I just had an interest in the more sustainable side and the waste, in particular waste. I really hate to see things go to waste, and it's actually that drove my interest in sustainability and business sustainability.
Do you think you said it was a dawning realization. Was it an epiphany moment, or was it just something that built up over time?
No, it really did. It built up over time. in my early career, I was actually with a New Zealand manufacturing background, and then that actually, you know, it shut down because it more and more moved offshore. So my work moved offshore with it. But then in recent years, there's suddenly been a focus on the fact that we should be buying local and supporting local and building the New Zealand economy, building the New Zealand skill base. And we were losing so much of that knowledge and resource. People are moving offshore now. And you realise that to become more sustainable, New Zealand needs to actually look back at developing their own product and not being so reliant on overseas, like fast FMCG, like your coffees and your teas, they all come from overseas. We need to look more local, for more local production.
If a company is selling itself as sustainable and its products are being made in a factory of some quality in wherever it might be, in China or somewhere in Vietnam, can they be both of those things?
Oh, that's such a tough one, isn't it? Because New Zealand's so far away from anywhere, so even just to get product here, there's a big carbon footprint in moving it. So I think some of the businesses I work with at the moment, they're into reusing and recycling. So, making products out of recycled plastic as opposed to virgin plastic. And so they're contributing to the global reduction in waste, but it would still be better to see a New Zealand manufacturer recycle plastic in New Zealand, right? That's the alternative position. And I'd love to see New Zealand get to that. I mean, we actually have, if you take labour out of the equation, if you build tech solutions, high-tech solutions, where labour's not a huge component of it, then New Zealand can do these things cost-effectively. Just that once you put hands in there and labour in there, products become really expensive.
Is it something that we can do through efficiencies and fine-tuning of supply chains and so on? Or is it something that's going to take wholesale business models? And I'm thinking of the sort of disruption that Interface Carpet shifting to a service model.
Oh, gosh. I think there are a lot of existing businesses and existing technologies in New Zealand. So it's not a complete start from scratch, but the problem I'm facing at the moment is actually just getting buy-in, like senior buy-in and buy-in across the organisation to, instead of doing this as cheaply as we can and pushing out as much as we can into the market, to do more with less and spend more money and make more jobs in New Zealand. And it costs more, but we build more. The more we move overseas, the less value we're adding in the New Zealand economy. It's a really sad situation. I don't actually know how we're going to address this. I know that we actually can't survive without, say, tea and coffee coming from overseas. But, there's got to be some balance between importing what we must and what we need and then making our own and developing our own where we can.
One view of the way that we can promote sustainability, particularly to businesses, has been the argument that if it's more sustainable, then it's more efficient, it's going to be cheaper, so you might as well do it that way. But it sounds as though people are beginning to go beyond that, to maybe it's okay that it's going to be more expensive.
I really hope so. So I've been trying to sell sustainable products or alternative products for 20 years. And in the early days of the early 2000s, the price of a more sustainable product was triple. And then over time, we've gradually got it down to being the same price or a very small cost differential. And even though there's a lot of noise in the market about we want sustainable, we're willing to pay more for it, when I look at the numbers selling out, I'm not seeing that transition to the sustainable alternatives as much as you think you should be. However, I do have hope because my son's he's nearly 20. And I see him and his friend group far more aware of the environmental impact of goods and far less aware of the costs. And I'm not sure whether it's just because he doesn't live on his own yet and he hasn't started paying for stuff, or whether he's just not as aware, not as to buy the cheapest is not part of his mandate. I mean, he doesn't really care as much about price. He doesn't care as much about fashion or any of those things as I think has been traditional. So, I mean, I'm not just picking on my son as being not caring about things like the fashion. I see that in his friends and his friend group. They're far more sensitive to the the global environment than I think my generation was at the same stage in life. So it makes me, when I'm bringing products into the New Zealand market and I'm looking at developing new products, it makes me really hopeful that the younger generation will actually start to show with their wallets a preference for these more sustainable types of goods.
We hear a lot about, if we're trying to sell, we as a country, trying to sell things to the big supermarkets in the UK, Tesco's or something, that if it's not sustainable, if it's not net zero or whatever, then we're not going to be able to sell it. Does that happen the other way, that the things we're trying to buy are sustainable already or something?
So in terms of, the government's leading there in a lot of the regulation and the specifications they make in their products. So if I was trying to respond to a government tender, I find that they have really up-specced what they're looking for. So they're looking for top of the range, every single environmental credential that's available. And they also look at how it's provided. Are there the solar panels in the warehouses are using? Are the factories trying to reduce water? So by the fact that they're looking for that type of product, it doesn't preclude others from coming in, but it is showing that there is an interest and an appetite to only bring in good quality products, highly specced products. So we'll definitely find that if you're cutting down rainforests to make paper product, it's not illegal to bring in, but it's becoming practically illegal to bring that in, because you can't, the paper certifications aren't there. No one will sell. No one will buy paper that has a rainforest cut down.
But they're not going to put a sticker on it to say that, are they?
No. So you have to have the sticker that says, FSC accredited or forest, you're right. They're not going to put a sticker on it, but hope that people are becoming more and more aware of what these, product certifications mean.
When you
start looking for them.
When you're buying things, are you able to go like a couple of layers deep on the supply chain? Are you expecting people to go a bit further?
Yes, I do sometimes have a little bit of a problem with, there's a lot of attention around the anti-trafficking and labour laws at the moment, and supposedly banning purchasing products from companies that have trafficked but it's all about a fair and reasonable workplace, but no one is actually quantifying what a fair and reasonable workplace is. So a fair and reasonable workplace in New Zealand is something that means probably reasonable work hours, not weekends, a decent paycheck. But if you're looking at a factory in, say, China, because I've visited many in China, and if you are saying, is that fair and reasonable, where they're working 6 days a week, longer hours, they have meal breaks, but basically they barely get outside. So, is that fair and reasonable? And who's checking that? I don't see. I know that you can employ companies to check this for you, but even so, I'm not sure who's making sure that that's a robust, verified.
If you were a consumer, you are a consumer as well, wearing your consumer hat, what can we do to maximise the sustainability-ness, let's pretend that's a word, of the things we buy?
Be prepared to pay more for it, or buy local, and not only buy local, like buy from local businesses as opposed to big corporates. That's if you vote with your wallet, that's the way that's what people pay attention to. That's what buyers pay attention to. That's what people putting product on the shelves in the supermarkets pay attention to. So it's going to take a long term change, but we've got to go back to the way that our parents and grandparents shopped, and go to your butcher, go to your greengrocer. Baker, local businesses, more so than the big box retailers that we see. It's a really big change. But if you remember in the 80s, there's actually quite a lot of resistance to the likes of the warehouse coming along, because it actually disrupted communities at a local level. And we then all got used to that. But now we're actually not wanting to go back to how it was. So it's really hard to put the sort of genie back in the bottle.
Let's take the first of your music tracks. Let's have Green Day, Time of Your Life. Why this one?
It's been a favourite song of mine for a long time. I think it's actually about a relationship breakup, but it's just a good way of saying, are you having the time of your life?
Mm-hmm. another turning point, a fork stuck in the road. Time grabs you by the wrist, directs you where to go. So make the best of this test and don't ask why. It's not a question but a lesson learned in time. It's something unpredictable, but in the end is right. I hope you had the time of your life. So take the photographs and still frames in your mind, hanging on a shelf in good health and good time. Tattoos and memories and dead skin on trial. For what it's worth, it was worth all the while. It's something unpredictable, but in the end is right. I hope you had the time of your life. But in the end it's right. I hope you had the time of your life. It's something unpredictable, but in the end it's right. I hope you had the time of your life.
Bubble sprite of the forest of Orokanui, Dunedin's favourite goddess, Tahu Mackenzie.
Mōrena, kōtua tahua. Mama henui kia tātou. It's lovely to have this time to speak with you. A huge thank you to you all for being alive, for being born, for manifesting and manifesting upon this beautiful earth and bringing your unique skills and gifts with you. And not only your own unique skills and gifts, but those of your ancestors, all the way back, I Tati Mataka. And for me, that is all life. All life helps us to realise who we are, and vice versa. We are nature observing herself, which is a great privilege afforded to us as a species. I was speaking with a beautiful lady in the Lindis Pass last night, and we were talking about how the tui and many other birds map the landscape with their song hypersonically and send it out and find where things are and what the other manu are doing and what a great skill this is. And of course how we ourselves do this with our human technologies, whether it's smoke symbols or song lines or sculptural references to the landscape, or motiatia, or pūrākau stories, whatever it is. And now, of course, satellites and Starlink and technology and clocks and watches and maps and all these things. You know, I love us as a species and I love our capacities to help the world around us, which I feel is the best way that we can use our skills. And it's fascinating how we're able to understand where we are and who we are all the time in new ways. So I really hope for you at the moment, having weathered the last several years of change and transformation, that you're finding ways to understand who you are now in a new position, in a new landscape, with a new vantage point and perhaps with a new destination. I know for myself the last several years have really tempered me in the crucible, as they say, and many of the ambitions and desires which I feel were associated with a younger aspect of me have been burned away in the fires of this change, and I'm very grateful for that. I now have so much more appreciation for the ordinary in my life, the very simple freedoms of which we are afforded, the capacity to love and connect with those around me, be they an eel or my beautiful godmother and friends and family and wider whānau of the forest. I love noticing how the trees at Orokunui are growing and changing with every day. I'll be back there tomorrow and I'm sure I'll see changes. How the Te Te Puna move, for example, the riflemen have moved from inside to outside the fence and are now regaling us with their beautiful high calls around the ramp at the visitor centre. And all these changes which we see as time moves are testament, of course, to our own resilience, our own Māori and Wairoa, our own life force and soul and spirit that guides us and sustains us through this world. And the capacity to see and hear and feel and touch and taste, all these things are gifts for us to remind us of this unusual and curious and different life that we lead as a species. So I really hope for you, you're having experiences which are grounding you. You're having experiences which are allowing you to enjoy the ordinary, everyday luxury of life that we're all sharing. And of course for me, hearing the inspiring stories from around the world that are shared on this program is always a reminder of the joy that we can find as we move in different directions to nurture our hearts. So a huge thank you to Sam and the whole Blowing Bubbles team for having me with you. I'm speaking with you from a sunny Sapporo Bello, where I'm staying with my beautiful whānau at the moment. So I hope where you are, your view is beautiful too. And I look forward to talking to you again soon. Thanks so much. Ka kite.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. We're talking with Nicola Wilson.
Nicola, we're going to play your podcast now, which is really different from your day job. So it seems to have been a theme with all of the submissions that we've had. What in particular would you like the listeners to know before they hear your podcast, and what would you like them to listen for?
Oh, goodness, that's a thoughtful question to start with. So, as you know, Māori, it comes up in my podcast, I have cystic fibrosis, and I've been managing that all my life. And recently there's been a cure for that, reasonably speaking, a cure for that. So from being very ill, I'm now actually back engaged with a real life, and I'm re-establishing all these contacts and entering the world. And I'm just really enjoying that. And I want people to know that there is another stage of life. If you've had ill health or you've had things go wrong, you can move past it, and you do move past it. I'm really determined to enjoy that. So that's part of the reason. So I found it really difficult when I was ill to tell people that I was ill. I'm finding it less difficult to tell people that I was ill and now I'm better. So it's just to bring in a little bit of a voice to something that I've managed my whole life and been very private about.
Kia ora everyone. My name is Nicola, and today I'm talking with Carmen Bradstreet in this episode of Coming Up for Air. I'm one of about 530 New Zealanders living with a condition called cystic fibrosis. It's classified as a rare disease here in New Zealand, although it's actually one of the most commonly inherited genetic conditions in the Western world. CF is a disease that primarily affects the lungs and the digestive system, with a host of high, complex health needs. There is an estimated global population of around 100,000 people living with CF, and one in every 3,500 newborns is diagnosed annually. Recently, there has been a transformative medical breakthrough in CF research, And in 2019, the Trikafta drug was approved by the FDA and was finally available to the market. In April 2023, Trikafta became publicly funded in New Zealand. It's my privilege to be talking to Carmen today in this Sea of Awareness Month to hear her story of resilience and perseverance and her role in the not straightforward pathway to getting this miracle drug funded in New Zealand.
So, kia ora, Carmen.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start, Carmen, with you telling me a bit about yourself. Now, where did you grow up? And maybe a little bit about how CF has affected you growing up.
So I'm from Auckland. I grew up in Papakura, so South Auckland. I was diagnosed with CF at about 3 months old. I was quite well growing up until I was about six. That was when I had my first hospitalisation due to chest infections. So with CF, you have an excess of mucus in your body in all sorts of organs, mainly the pancreas and the lungs. So with mucus sitting on your lungs, it's essentially a wonderful breeding ground for bacteria. As a result, you get infections in your lungs and you have to take antibiotics regularly. And when oral antibiotics don't work, you're admitted to hospital and given IV antibiotics. So from about six, I spent a couple of weeks every year in hospital. As with anyone with CF, every year and every infection brings about a slow decline in lung function. Probably I was able to stay stable until my early teens. I guess I was always determined to kind of tick off the normal things of life, you know, university, getting married, having children, buying a home, that kind of thing. Of course, having CF, it was always that much harder, and you always felt like your life was sort of compressed, like you had to do everything a lot faster because you only had, you know, at the time, I think the life expectancy was about 27 years. This is when I was a teenager. So in my mind, it was like, okay, go to university, work for a couple of years, have children, and then die. So I never planned beyond being a mother.
So I was born in the 70s, Carmen, and at that point, CF was a death sentence. I've lived on the extending life expectancy my entire life.
Yeah, I understand that. It's like it seemed like as I was growing up, as I kind of got closer to each life expectancy, it would be bumped up.
So in April 2023, Trikafta became available in New Zealand. Trikafta is the equivalent of the insulin drug becoming available for diabetics. So it's not a cure, but it takes what has been a progressively fatal disease and turns it into a manageable, survivable condition. I understand you were actually instrumental in bringing this to the attention of the New Zealand health professionals. Is that right?
I can't take all credit. There were so many people involved. It truly was a joint effort. Lots of people don't realise the amount of planning and strategy and everything that went into it. And that started long before the first public coverage of it. I remember sort of speaking with Sir Bob Elliott before he passed away and before the campaign kickstarted, and he was sort of following my journey with CF, and we messaged from time to time, and I had managed by way of donation to try Trikafta, and it improved my health remarkably. I mean, I was in a really bad spot with my health. My lung function was sort of sitting in the low 40s because I caught the H1N1 flu. Once you drop into sort of over in the 30%, they're starting to talk lung transplant. So, of course, I was thinking to myself, oh, my God, I've just had all these years wiped off my life and I've got this young child at home. So, anyway, I managed to try Trikafta and the results were incredible. I remember taking it and I think it was 2.5-3 days later, I redid my lung function and it was in the 80s. It was 86%. That was double. And I mean, for context, anything above 85% lung function and you're considered normal. This drug worked better than what I could ever have expected or hoped. So anyway, so I messaged Sir Bob Elliott with my results. And of course, I'd been in the meantime, I'd been like, you know, what can we do to get this? How can we make it? Is there an option to get the raw ingredients? Can I make it myself? Can there be a generic made in India? Can I somehow get enough money? At the time, $360,000 a year. Can I somehow get enough money to buy this? And because the results were so phenomenal, it's all very well to hear these stories from overseas patients, but but there's nothing like seeing it in your own backyard.
Absolutely.
To really grasp it.
Because, you know, from my own experience, I could see sitting here in New Zealand, I could see Trikafta being developed overseas and I can see people taking it. But I just never in a million years thought, you know, New Zealand takes so long to get things.
Mm-hmm.
I never thought we'd get access to this drug in the time frame that I needed it to, because I was going down the route of a lung transplant. It's now 1 year since your campaign was successful. Tell me a little bit about the challenges and the highlights of this campaign to get Trikafta. Can you tell me some of the highlights for you, or some of the absolute challenges that you had to go through to get this drug across the line?
I mean, obviously there were lots of challenges along the way, but we took a really, it was a strategic approach. We had to look into policy, we had to look into processes, and we had to be sure that, you know, in order to call out, say, the government or PharmAc, we had to make sure we'd dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's and followed, you know, we'd made a submission for this or we'd asked for this. Because, I mean, I remember one of the very first things was Vertex, which is the drug company who produces Trikafta, saying, well, we didn't know people in New Zealand wanted Trikafta, because no one had been like, hey, this we need or want this drug. And I think a lot of that came from the attitude of the CF population, where it just felt, as you mentioned, felt so out of reach. It was like, by the time we get that, I'm gonna be dead. You're so caught up in just surviving day to day that you don't have the energy to advocate for yourself or be contacting drug companies or PharmAc and that kind of thing. Which leads to, I guess, a highlight where, for me, it was the CF community just coming together. It was
absolutely
incredible. The number of people that got on board and were like, what can we do? How can we help? Tell us what to do. That was just, the amount of support from the community was incredible.
So, Carmen, one of the most high-profile parts of the campaign was the petition that you organised. How many signatories did you get to that petition?
We managed to get just over 43,000. So
wow, that's amazing.
A little bit shy of 50, but 43 right. was an incredible
And so
achievement.
What was the intent behind the petition, and why did you use this as a vehicle to drive awareness, I suppose?
So with the petition, we always knew it was never about the numbers. The petition was about the publicity that could come from it. It was about another pressure point on PharmAc and the government. And I guess it was a chance to, you know, if we could get in front of the select committee, it was a chance to sort of say our piece and to, you know, tackle head on some of the rebuttal that we'd had from PharmAc and the government. Because for anyone that's dealt with PharmAc and the government, I mean, to give them their due, it's made up of people. It's made up of people who do want good outcomes, but there is a lack of accountability. There is almost like a little loophole for them, because, you know, you contact PharmAc and they say, well, you know, we're funded by the government, we can only do what we can with the money that government give us. And then then you go to government and government says, well, we can't influence PharmAc in their decisions, they're independent.
Both parties can sort of point at the other party as the reason why. We're talking specifically about Trikafta today and getting that funded, and that campaign was long enough, but there are still many other drugs that are not available in New Zealand that are commonly available in other OECD countries. So New Zealand is lagging behind. Why do you think we're lagging so far behind? Is it health, and what can we do to move the dial in this area?
I think there's two main aspects there. So number one is the obvious one, which is funding. So we proportionate spending. So I'm not talking about absolute, I'm talking about proportionate. I think the vote health budget, there's 5% that's allocated to pharmaceuticals, to PharmAc. Whereas, you know, you look over the ditch at Australia and it's 15%. So there is a lack of funding. You've also got a lack of urgency, I feel. So there's hoops you have to jump through. You know, you have to get MedSafe approval, and then it has to go to PharmAc, and then they go through various subcommittees, and then it gets put on the list, the options for investment list, and then it has to find its way off there, which is where a lot of drugs kind of languish. So that's a big one.
Lead up to this campaign, I was reading Andrew Little had a lot to say about the cost of Vertex. It should be illegal to make a drug and then put such a price tag on it.
I did actually think about this earlier today, and I think there is kind of a question mark over how ethical it is to have pharmaceutical companies charging that the amount that they do for drugs. A big one for Vertex is they're a listed company, so they're on the stock exchange. So their main aim is to, of course, have healthy profit margins for their investors. Should pharmaceuticals be allowed to be publicly listed companies? I mean, that's not something that I agree with, unless they're a company that then puts back into the community by, say, funding these drugs for in third world countries where we know that those drugs will never be funded by their health systems. So, yeah, there is a bit of a blurred line there. Andrew Little's comments, it was to detract attention away from, I think, the areas where Pharmac and the government were lacking. I mean, I remember before speaking to the health committee, the question to me was, well, what pressure are you going to put on Vertex in this campaign? I said to them, are you asking a group of sick and dying patients to put pressure and lobby against a multinational pharmaceutical company?
Absolutely. And where is the onus on the politician to actually leverage Vertex as well? You know, there's only 100,000 CFs in the world, and it's an estimate. And if they were all eligible for this Trikafta drug at, you know, $350,000 per year, that is an obscene amount of profit.
I guess, I mean, being devil's advocate here, you've also got to remember that millions, potentially hundreds of millions of dollars get put into research.
Absolutely.
That's, it costs a phenomenal amount. And especially if you're dealing with a condition where there is a limited market, it is going to end up being a high-cost drug. But does it have to be as high-cost as what it is?
It is quite hard for both you and I to have perspective here because, of course, we're dependent on Vertex to supply the drug. So we want the drug and we don't want to cut that off in any way. But at a certain point, you know, it is very expensive. Talking about a small population of CFs, I think one of the unintended consequences of now having a drug that treats CF so well is we're now going to see an explosion in the population of people with CF. One, because we're living longer, but two, because women with CF are now having children.
I mean, I'm part of, you know, CF mothers groups and other groups on Facebook, and the term that's been coined for the children that we're now having are Trikafta babies.
So what is the drug Trikafta meant for you, Carmen? What difference, what changes has it made in your life?
Well, it's definitely, without doubt, improved my life. I'm in hospital less frequently. My lung function is now sort of sitting in the 70s, 70%, as opposed to back when I was sort of in the 40s. I'm able to recover from chest infections a lot easier, less antibiotics, less day-to-day maintenance is probably the big one. You know, I'm not sitting there on multiple nebulizers a day, not needing as much physiotherapy. I'm able to stay active with my children, which, I mean, I think if you listen to my petition speech, I talked about how I would get breathless reading my child a book in the evening. That was probably one of the low points in my life. And I mean, I now have a second child. So he wouldn't exist if Trikafta hadn't came along.
And I can add a little bit there from my perspective as well, because Carmen, you know that when you first met me, I was on the lung transplant list myself and too tired to fight for Trikafta myself. I was not working. I was basically home. I was on oxygen 24/7, feeding tube, multiple antibiotics, so out of hospital for basically 10 weeks at a time. But since I've gone on to Trikafta, I'm now back at work and I'm taking part in online study.
Just touching back on your point about work, you know, you've managed to go back to work and increase your days. That's another thing for me, is I'd kind of almost accepted the fact that I wouldn't really be back in the workforce beyond sort of your little casual contracting stint.
I've gone from doing nothing to now actually having to focus on how do I re-engage in the workforce? How do I re-engage in the world, actually? There's a lot of time in the 3 years leading up to Trikafta where I was actually in the house 24/7. I was too ill to leave the house. If I did go out of the house, I would have to take my portable oxygen with me. And that's no fun, you know, grocery shopping with your little prongs in. And now suddenly I'm not actually looking at, you know, tidying up the last few years of my life. I'm actually looking at, I need to earn a living. I need to support myself. I need to still have social networks. I need to have friends and I need to have hobbies. And I've had to sort of re-find these things. I'm really enjoying it. I'm really enjoying it. But it's a psychological shift. It's quite difficult to navigate.
There's a lot of people who say, you know, they'd missed lots of school, lots of their education, they hadn't been able to go to university or into the workforce.
Or even plan for a career.
Exactly. And now they're kind of like, I've got all this opportunity in front of me. I don't know what to do with it. Imagine if CF is such a minor inconvenience with minor patients. Imagine if it could be handled by, say, a GP mainly.
So, Carmen, just to wrap up this interview today, I've got a question now that we're asking all our coming up for air interviewees. So if you could change one thing right now that would make a significant positive difference for the future, what would that be?
I think it would be a review of Pharmac and potentially the processes that new medications have to go through to be approved and funded, and also a review of the proportionate spending on healthcare by the government. As a CF person, you, as anyone really that requires an expensive medication, it was kind of like, well, why me over another disease? Mm-hmm. And we kind of had to change people's way of thinking. It was like, let TRIKAFTA be the example and let it pave the way. So we almost wanted to set a precedent, and I believe that we have. For example, absolutely. I know that MedSafe, they had a mechanism where they could assess a medication, but it had to be a cancer medication at the same time as what Pharmac was assessing it. So concurrently, instead of one after the other, which is where, you know, MedSafe would have it first and then it would go to Pharmac. And so we challenged that, and subsequently TRIKAFTA was assessed by MedSafe at the same time as Pharmac. And that, to be honest, probably took 2 years potentially off the time.
The process, absolutely.
I think the other thing as well is it was the first time ever that we'd called for a stakeholder meeting between Vertex, Pharmac, MedSafe and Cystic Fibrosis New Zealand, where everyone sat down in a room to talk about next steps and what we can do and what they needed and what you know, get a clear process for everything. That was the first of its kind as well. And to be fair on Pharmac and MedSafe, they granted that. They helped make that happen. They were key. I think a big thing was also that relationship management. We always wanted a campaign that wasn't aggressive, because at the end of the day, we knew that it was people that were working in these roles, yes, and making decisions. Yes, they had guidelines, but you needed people on your side.
Is there any advice you'd give to someone, because I mean, TRIKAFTA is not the only drug that needs to be funded, not the only expensive drug. Is there any advice you'd give to other people running a similar campaign? What do you think was the key for you to being successful?
I think the key was definitely having, so TRIKAFTA for Kiwis, having the right skill set in there, and having the right relationship with stakeholders, and also being fully aware of all the steps required to get a drug funded. So we had to basically lay that out and look, you know, where can we realistically speed this up? Is it at this point or this point or this point? So it was really breaking down the campaign. And also at each milestone along that timeline, you had to look at what messaging you needed to be out in the public or to the stakeholders. And I know that sounds probably quite strategic, but you know, if you have the public behind you, your campaign is just so much stronger, and you can't leave areas where the public, you know, question your credibility right, or anything like that. So that's why the messaging had to be so consistent. So at no point was it exaggerated, though. I mean, CF is a cruel disease. But yes, you were telling the truth. It was all facts. It was like, what did you want to emphasize? What did you want people to take away? And how can you best tell your story? So that was key. And definitely having advocates. So Paddy Gower was just invaluable, I think.
Yes. What was Paddy Gower's connection?
So he didn't have a personal connection.
I think Paddy was so keen to help because he recognised the urgency of the situation. He realised we had a compelling story, and he essentially helped us tell that story to New Zealand. He helped us be heard. New Zealand can't keep dragging the chain when it comes to the funding of new modern medicines. We will forever be behind the rest of the world by up to decades if we don't start improving the process by which new medicines are assessed and approved and ultimately funded. And that is something that Pharmac and the government are jointly responsible for.
congratulations, Carmen, on how successful that campaign was to you and the group behind you. There are so many people now living a much healthier, happier life, and we're so grateful. We're so grateful and so well done. Thanks for your time today, Carmen.
You're welcome. It's absolutely my pleasure to be speaking with you.
Thanks for listening. Kai tera.
Nicola, that was really well done. That was so interesting. Thank you very much. Thank you for being so open and honest about such a personal thing.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure. As I said, I'm enjoying bringing a voice to a really large part of my life that I've kept as private as possible over the years.
It's hard. I can relate to that from, and Sam probably will be able to relate to that from having journeyed with me through my doctorate, having a heart condition, being very unwell, and then coming out the other end of that and restarting my life. So I totally can relate to
you
that.
You do.
Sometimes it's easier to talk about it after than when
That's
you're
right.
in the thick of it. What did you gain most from this, the process that you've been through with the podcast and the interview and...
Oh, well, actually, I'm a bit of a tech phobe, I suppose, and, you know, a little bit of a nana in that sense. But I did find it, I'm really pleased with myself that I can learn new skills, and I actually really enjoyed it. And, yeah, you get all self-conscious about how horrible you sound, and I couldn't get it to flow really well, and I had some technical difficulties with getting my microphone settings right. But I can learn new things, and it was cool, and it was a really cool experience to talk to my interviewee. She was a really media savvy. She's done quite a few interviews, so you know it was very smooth for her. But I guess a lot more practice is required, but you can see that over time you'll be able to engage with people, and I might be able to do this, you know, to talk to more people and put little podcasts on my Facebook pages and things like that if I so desire. So it's great. I appreciate having a new skill.
Well, actually, I hope that you do, because you've got something really huge to offer, something different. You're not just, you know, so many podcasts are all the same old, but you've got something really different to offer because you've got a lived experience and a massive life transformation, and that is going to guide a lot of other people through that in their own lives.
I hope so. I'm glad you found it interesting. You know, it's easy to, it's my life, so I do find it quite interesting, but, you know, it's nice to put it out there and find other people. I do find people are genuinely interested in my experience and what it was like, what it was like being really ill, and then what it's also like re-entering life as well. So, you know, I've got lots to say, I find.
Did you kind of, as you were going through that process of having this transformation, did you find goal setting was helpful, or just day-to-day living? How did it work for you?
So I think I did look ahead and have goals, but then now when I look back, I realise it was a little bit more of a natural flow than that, and I realise when I look back, I can see how far I've come without, I mean, you know, for example, you know, I only recently gave my oxygen machine back. I've only recently had my portacath out. So even though I've been well for a year, there are still like remnants of things. And, you know, every step, you know, every day is another step in the right direction. And yeah, I now look back over 2 years and realise, wow, how far I've come. And, you know, I'm still looking ahead at what might come next, you know.
And what is next?
Oh, well, I'm going to finish my master's degree first. So I'm hoping to finish that by the end of this year. I mean, I'm on track to finish that by December. So I've really enjoyed the study that I've done over the last 2 years. I mean, Monday nights, Moa, do you know? It's actually such an enjoyable experience. Like, we're online with like-minded people, and we're real passionate, and we're getting in there, and we don't always agree, but we're very respectful and polite about disagreeing. So, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do on a Monday night when I don't have that class anymore. So I don't know, but I've already started looking at maybe these other things, other courses or other, you know, other ways to spend my Monday night. And not to mention the weekends of studying. Yeah, so I see myself having a bit of capacity to take on new things. We'll see
what that...
we'll see what comes next. Yes, it is exciting.
I have some questions to end the show. Oops, not very much time. We're going to have to riddle. What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Oh, goodness. Going back to work probably is what ended up being really important to me in terms of normalising me again. And I've really enjoyed it. And so not only am I back at work, I'm actually meaningfully back at work. People are looking to me for, like, I'm now the sustainability manager in my workplace, and they are looking to me for leadership and change and transformation. So I get a lot of esteem out of that, I suppose. I'm happy that people are listening to me, more interested in listening to me.
Do you think there's a message in that personal transformation of yourself that you can bring to that transformation of workplace?
I think so. I do. Sometimes it's a little ironic that my own life was not that sustainable, but now I've come back to being fully alive again, and now I'm worried about sustainable everything. So, I guess I'm taking that bigger picture because now I've got a future to look forward to. I want to make sure I am looking forward to it, and there's something for others to look forward to too, my son, the generation coming behind me. So I see that's how it's leaning, like sustainability sort of, it's marrying my personal sustainability with a world to live in.
What is your superpower?
I think I'm really easy to talk to, and I'm a good listener. So if you've got a problem, you can come to me, and I'll listen. And that's actually been a massive superpower for me, because people do come to me, and I am able to guide in a sort of motherly, nurturing way, I suppose. And I enjoy that role, being available to people.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Oh goodness! So there's this whole sustainability field. There's a real mix of the activists and the pragmatists, right? And you have to be a little bit of both. So I think, yes, in the end, to get things done, you do have to act. But I'm also not the activist that chains myself to fences in front of moving, you know, bulldozers. I'm not that much of an activist. I'm a speak up activist.
Do you have a go-to definition of sustainability?
Oh, I really like the United Nations one, which is about meeting the needs of the future without compromising. Oh no, meeting the feed. Now I can't recall what it is. Meeting the needs of the future without compromising the needs of today. And I think it might be the other way around, right? Meeting the needs of today without compromising the needs of the future. There you go, that's better.
Got there.
Got there in the end. I do like that quote. Now you just put me on the spot and I couldn't think of it off the top of my head.
So what is the biggest challenge or opportunity you're looking forward to in the next year or so?
I don't want everything to be, but on a work level, we're doing our carbon footprint and we're setting our carbon reduction targets. And I'm looking forward to having a meaningful strategy around reducing our carbon footprint and actually making steps towards achieving that. So we're not only setting an appropriate emissions reduction strategy, we're actually following it. And it would be great to see companies like myself, so companies like ours, actually hitting their reduction targets.
Indeed. And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Oh, just go out there and live your life and have fun. And you can always reinvent yourself. You know, you just need to appreciate life for what it is and roll with the punches a little bit and see what comes your way and try and enjoy it and do the best you can to be as sustainable and eco-friendly as possible, I suppose. We've got a lot of change to come. I mean, climate's going to give us a lot of change. So you sort of got to be a little bit flexible and open to change and just seeing what comes up. So
that's
my advice to the listeners. Go out there and do it.
Sounds good to me. Mawira.
Nicola, thank you very much for all that you have brought to our shared learning space, for your kindness towards everybody, for the way that, and I would love it, you'd go off into your group, have our breakout rooms, you would come back, and the way that you reported everybody's view in such a fair and equitable and wonderful way, the world is lucky to have you in it. We are certainly lucky to have you in our class, and I wish you all the best for the journey ahead. Thank you for sharing with us.
Thanks, Mawira. Oh, it's been my pleasure to talk to you today, and it's my pleasure to talk in class as well.
Thank you, Nicola. We're going to go out to the Cranberries, Zombies.
All right.
You've been listening to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. Brought to you by the Sustainable Lens team, which is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. We had a contribution today from Tahu McKenzie. This was an episode from our series Coming Up for Air. Today's contributor was Nicola Wilson. With Mawira Karatai, I'm Samuel Mann. That was Blowing Bubbles. We hope you enjoyed the show. Mate wā.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.